Hey, this is episode 29 of the Mentoring Developers podcast. You can go to mentoringdevelopers.com/episode29 for show notes, highlights, and you can also leave your comments there.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Before we start the show, I have a favor to ask you. You know, this show is all about new and aspiring software developers and their mentors. And I want to interview and I want to bring out stories from all of you. Whether you are a junior developer, you want to be a developer, maybe you work with developers, hire developers, maybe you mentor them. All of these stories put together build for us a complete picture, and then we can learn from our experiences and find out how we can be more successful, more inclusive, how we can have diversity, how we can encourage people to get better and encourage people to come to this field. If you want me to interview you, or if you want to be on a discussion panel, go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join. Hi everyone. Today I have a very special guest, somebody that you have heard before if you went to listen to episode 18. So mentoringdevelopers.com/episode18, you would have heard my interview with Sara Inez Calderon. Sara is a new developer. But back when I interviewed her, she had gotten her first job. Now she has moved into her second job, which is a better job. It pays better, better suited, and overall causes her to be happier. Is that true, Sara?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I think, I've just kind of finished my first week of this new job, but there's definitely several levels of better than the first programming job, which from what I understand is how tech jobs go.
So who are you? I think that our audience may have forgotten who you are. Tell us a little bit about Sara. Who's Sara?
Sure. So I'm Sara. I actually have transitioned in technology after working 10 years in the media, which kind of ranges from newspapers to like digital kind of blog publications, as well as a few media startups. And so kind of doing social media and analytics and things like that. Then I transitioned through Vis-a-Vis Sabio, a bootcamp in Los Angeles that focuses on diversity in tech. I became a .NET developer there. And then I moved to Austin. I became co-director of Women Who Code Austin. And here we do a lot of work around diversity, specifically gender diversity, but also ethnic diversity and, you know, LGBT diversity, a variety of things. And so that's kind of what I do and you know, who and what I do it through. And most recently, as you mentioned, I got my second tech job, just finished my first week in that position. And so it's a kind of a new adventure, the next step. And here we are.
Amazing. In a very short amount of time, when did you start thinking about becoming a programmer or software developer? How long has it been?
Sure. So I think when I was at the last startup at which I worked was a YouTube network. And so basically kind of started to tinker around with some of the back-end interfaces on YouTube, the YouTube platform. And I kind of started to realize that there was a lot of things going on there that I was curious about. And that if I had that domain knowledge, I think in that particular startup, what I really realized was that technical knowledge was going to allow me to grow professionally in a a way that I desired and I wanted, and also in a way that kind of having content knowledge never would allow me to, just based on the fact that men run a lot of these things and men treasure technical knowledge over other kinds of knowledge. And so that was my thinking at the time. So yeah, so that was like 2011 is when I started thinking about maybe I should move into a more technical role. I didn't actually get around to it until 2014, but here we are.
So from 2014 to 2016, it's a short 2-year period. Mm-hmm. In that period, you were able to make this decision to go into technology, not just technology, but software development, which is mm-hmm. one of the more difficult things to do in technology. And then not only mm-hmm. that, you decided, you learned a little bit on your own, and then you went to a code camp, very short mm-hmm. code camp, a few weeks, right?
It was, 12 weeks, 3 months.
So it's really short time to start a career. And then you got your first job, and you had to go through, I'm sure, a lot of interviews, difficulty. It's not easy to get your first job, and you really can't be that picky.
Yeah.
Right. So most of the time, if you are a new developer or you want to be a developer, you're just happy to get a job, any job. And a lot of times people will work for free. But in our industry, we're lucky that we don't actually have to do that because, you know, the budgets are large and companies generally have money to pay you, and they will pay you a little bit even if you intern. But if you have mm-hmm. a full-time job, they'll pay you something that's going to be considered decent on any other scale. Even if mm-hmm. it is low from, you know, maybe you're making less money than your peers, but it's still okay to start. But then very soon you realize that's not really what you want to do. Maybe the people, maybe the culture, maybe the company, maybe the money.
Sure.
What are some of the problems first time people who get their first jobs? What are some of the problems they face? Because you have your own experience, but you also are involved with the community.
Sure. So I think some of the most common issues are that, and this may be an age issue as well, because I'm actually grown up. Like as I mentioned, after college, I worked for 10 years before I started this. So I've been in the professional workforce for a while, though some of the people that I'm talking to, or many of them who are kind of in their first tech jobs, tend to be much younger than myself. So there's I think there's an initial kind of resistance or befuddlement at why nobody wants to change, why they insist on doing things a certain way or using a particular technology if it's not the best fit. So there's definitely that, but I guess that's just true of any, field. But yeah, I think that there's definitely like an old guard, I'd say, who tend to be mostly white males, and they have a clique, and it's hard to get into that clique unless you remind them of them when they were your age, I guess. So that's kind of a common thing that I hear, is it's hard to find mentorship. It's hard to find someone to help you. It's hard to find, camaraderie with the old guard sometimes. Also getting paid. I mean, there are, unfortunately, I've seen some software development jobs here in Austin where they're actually, I don't understand why somebody would be paid in the 30s or the 40s to do software when you can probably make more money than that waiting tables in this town.
So you're talking about $30,000 or $40,000 a year salaries for full-time software engineers. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how much experience you have or if you have no experience. In America, in the U.S. in 2016, you cannot pay people $30,000 or $40,000. And I think we should talk about more openly about salaries, because a lot of new people coming into the field, even people who have been here for a while, they don't really know how much they're worth, and they're just happy to get an offer and they'll take it, and they don't know how to negotiate. And only that, when it comes time for their yearly reviews, they don't really know how to negotiate a better salary, and then they're taken advantage of. I mean, you can't live in any mid-sized or large city in America in that kind of an income. But you're basically living as a student. That's shocking, but that's prevalent, and I've seen it over and over.
Absolutely. So I'd say, you know, it's hard to find mentorship or acceptance or camaraderie or whatever you want to call that, which makes it hard to move up and get better. Then there's, you know, I think the gender component. I know several women who've kind of have worked in situations where, again, it's all men. And so all these things get said or insinuated. There are activities that the men will do and they just don't include you. Like, I don't think that they're often being bad people, but they're just not thinking, hey, maybe I should be more inclusive. Because they're just so used to working with men all the time. They're just in their, you know, modus operandi. They don't stop and think about it. And then, you know, there's some, I know I'm not the only one, but you know, there's some times where they'll say things like maybe they're joking because it's like a boys club. And so they'll make, you know, a joke about Mexicans or a joke about Indians or whatever. And you're just thinking to yourself, like, why is this happening to me? So those things happen. So the money thing is also another issue. But yeah, I think that more than anything, I guess what the way I would describe it is first timers kind of end up feeling kind of stuck. They're stuck, you know, technologically because they're not working with technology necessarily that they love. They're stuck professionally because they can't find people to help them move forward. And they're stuck culturally because they're not, I mean, I guess millennials, if we're talking about that generation, of which I am a part, although I am on the cusp. So, you know, they're supposedly the most diverse generation that the United States has ever produced. And I think that they have supposedly, according to surveys, more open attitudes towards diversity than their you know, previous cohorts. So, you know, they kind of get stuck culturally there as well. That being said, what I kind of tell, I talk to college age students, I talk to different groups, everything from boot camp graduates to college students to high school students to middle school students, and some of the work that I do. And what I do tell them is like, look, I've worked in the media for 10 years, and you know what? There were problems there too. And there was sexism there too. And there was racism there too. So what I will say about tech is that's great. And including with my previous job, my first job, which I left after just under 11 months, you know, there were great things about it. Like, it put me in a position financially to where I could help my family. Or, you know, certain members of my family, I could funnel money to them. I could help them with this. I could help them with that. I could take out, you know, boot camp grads for dinner and talk to them, you know, and it wasn't like an a financial burden for me to treat them to dinner or whatever. Like, it allowed me to buy, you know, to fix my car, like, without worrying about it. So, I mean, having that kind of financial stability, it will help you have a better life. That being said, you know, obviously you still have things to deal with. You know, the other thing about technology, which I think is, you know, as a career, which is really great, is what I tell people is it gives you the freedom to kind of, after you accrue a certain amount of experience, to pursue things you actually want to be doing, which isn't necessarily the case. And, you know, I will say in media, you're always kind of held hostage to whatever opportunities are available. And who do you know who's going to put you at the front of the line for those opportunities? So there are other industries where, you know, like, any industry is going to have these types of problems. That's just the nature of corporate. But what can you do once you're there? Like, can you move away? Can you move up? Can you say, hey, I want to, in my free time, study Ember and become an Ember expert and then get a job doing Ember, right? You can't do that necessarily in other fields. And so that's something that I think is good. So, you know, regarding my first job, I thought it was great, you know, financially. I thought it was great to get the experience. I did learn a lot. I did meet some people who could help me. It helped me figure out what I did like and didn't like about technology, right? And it definitely helped me get my foot in the door and, you know, kind of helped steer me towards what I did want. It's actually kind of funny. I had, after a few months at this position, I had written a list of the things that I wanted in my next job. So I was able to more pointedly search for my next position. So that's the thing. So I still do have people that I met at my first job that are now professional and personal acquaintances that I'm sure are going to come back around, especially because Austin isn't a huge metro area. So I'm sure we'll run into each other professionally again. So that's good. I mean, some of the bad things were that I, you know, as I mentioned, I did hear some less than appropriate I did hear, you know, more than I had cared to experience and more than I had previously experienced in other positions, inappropriate workplace things, whether it was like, you know, I mean, and that's the thing is like, I worked in the media, which is also male dominated. So it's not like I'm have a super soft skin or anything, but at the same time, like I did hear some things that I thought were inappropriate. I heard, I think more than anything, the things that bothered me were the implicit things. So, you know, this, when people tell racist jokes to my face, that makes me very uncomfortable. When people make assumptions or illusions about a particular group of people, in this case, you know, Indians or Chinese, that makes me uncomfortable. But when, you know, someone who may not be straight is around and you use all these kind of like code words about being sweet, it just kind of bothers me because you're bothered by it. You know, why are you bothered by this person? Things like that really kind of, I didn't think were appropriate. And honestly, that's not what I think is, in a business sense, having that attitude and fomenting attitudes like that isn't going to allow you to be successful in the long term. So those were kind of some of the things, but I think overall I take the experience I've had in technology as a primer, if you will, for like, okay, I had this media experience and I kind of have a very deep understanding of how that business works and how business works within that field. And so now I have this other experience and I have, you know, the maturity to understand what's happening at a different level so I can cherry pick and understand, you know, what is the business of tech like. So, yeah, so that's what I would say is were the good and the highlights of my first job.
Yeah, well, that's great because you bring up some really good points. One is that there are people in our industry, and unfortunately a lot of us, that we're not sensitive to other people's feelings. So it comes back to empathy that I talk about a lot in this podcast. It's very hard to have empathy if you don't see the person for who they are and you're thinking, oh, you know, I've always done this. I've always joked around. I don't mean it. I'm not a bad person. I don't hate them. You can say all these things and maybe you don't, and maybe you are a great person, but what you say affects other people. Mm-hmm. And when it affects other people, you need to watch it. Now you can do what you want in your own house. It's okay. You know, you can hold your views and act according to your views when you're not affecting other people. But in a professional environment, it shouldn't happen. But unfortunately, it does happen because we're all human and there are no code of conduct. Even if you had code of conduct, how do you implement it? Then you need to have this regimented, you need to have a high-handed approach. You need to fire people. That's not a great outcome either. So what we need to do is, I think we just raise awareness and hope that people are good people. And once they know that they are doing something wrong or affecting somebody negatively, then they will stop. But you know what? What we do wrong in our country, in this industry, is we put the onus on the victim to do it.
Yeah.
So if you're the victim, if you're offended, now go complain. Now they are going to address this particular complaint in isolation. So then you have to prove that you have been offended. First of all, you have to relive that experience. But secondly, it doesn't help the next person. Because the next person has to go through the same thing again. What we need is a system. We can say that we don't do this type of thing to anybody. And then it stops for everybody, for me and for the person that's going to be hired next. This one-on-one, oh, prove you're a victim or you're a baby, that kind of mentality is prevalent, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I hear it in a lot of podcasts. And a lot of other smart people have said that, you know, they say that in respect to racism, they say that in respect to sexism and all the other types of, we want our industry to be welcoming and to just welcome everybody. You know, you don't have to like them. You don't have to like what, you know, how they act, and you don't have to agree with them, but we should all be able to work together. And that's what we're trying to promote.
Well, to your point, and this is the thing that I think gets me is, as you said, that the onus of this is put on you as a woman or you as a minority whatever minority means in that context, right? And it's like, why are you, you know, they're saying that you're being too sensitive, that you're the problem. But let's take a step back here. Like, I'm not raising a big flag about diversity. I'm just asking why we're talking about this. And you're the one turning it into a huge deal. So I think you're the one that's being too sensitive, bro. Like, oftentimes, like, if it's a matter of sensitivity, I think that they're the ones, because they're so afraid of being called racist or sexist, you know, where it's like, no, I don't think you're racist. I just think you have a higher tolerance for racist things. Or I don't think that you are a walking embodiment of sexism, because I know you have daughters and I know you want the best for them. I think that you don't know how to behave around women in a professional context because you're not used to it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't even have that conversation because they're like, whoa, they freak out because they're sensitive, right? So that's, yeah.
So that's one of the problems that you face. The other one that you face is that generally you don't get a good salary and you're not, it's okay, but it's, you know, that you can, you should be able to get more. And some of the other issues now, you've come to a place where you've decided that you need to move on, but you're not ready because nobody knows you. You don't really have a portfolio. You just got your first job. Maybe it's been 6 months, maybe a year. So what did you do and what could somebody else do to set themselves up to be in a position to get their second job, a higher paying job, something that, you know, they're where they're happier?
Sure. So a couple of things. One, I would say, I think it's super important, I say this all the time, to create a digital presence that reflects what you want people to find when they Google you. And why is it important? Why is that important? What people Google, you know, who cares, right? Where it's all about the technology. But, you know, people are going to Google you before they hire you. They're going to look at your Facebook page. They're going to look at your Twitter feed. They're going to look at your LinkedIn. They're going to look at your website. I mean, I had a legacy website with my name on it and it wasn't responsive because it was built in like 2012 or something. My friend did it on WordPress and it wasn't, I wasn't thinking about web, but it brought, someone brought it up in one of my interviews, or her website's not responsive. So, you know, you have to make sure that when people Google you, they're going to find what you want them to find. And so if you want to be a tech person, you know, I have since updated that website. Now it's responsive, right? So that's what I would say is super important. One, two, that can be accomplished, you know, through meetups and stuff sometimes. Like, you can volunteer at a meetup or, you know, meet people at meetups and kind of, you know, create a, you know, segue into becoming that tech person that way. But what I think is super important is to code and study outside of work. I mean, that's something that I've been doing and it sucks and it's hard, especially because in my previous position, I had a commute that really kind of dug into my personal time outside of work, right? That being said, the more I did it, the more I found ways to do it better. So unfortunately, I didn't know this when I first started out, but you can go onto GitHub and find an open source project that has kind of some of the components you want, and you can clone it and you can change it and make it your own, right? And people do this all the time. And apparently this is a thing and I didn't know this. And so, you know, go on a GitHub and look for some code and adapt it to what you want and create your own side project. I mean, that's certainly something that I think has helped me either get interviews or, you know, get a job. Do you have like an interest in your craft? Do you code outside of work? Do you do side projects? Are you trying to grow? Maybe that means you have certifications from like lynda.com or you do a Coursera course or some other thing. So that's what I would say is, one, you need to work on your skills outside of work, whether that means going to a hackathon, getting a mentorship, doing a meetup, writing your own, you know, projects. You need to be doing that. You need to make sure that your digital presence is what you want it to be, because, again, people are going to be Googling you outside of your LinkedIn and your resume. So what are they going to, what story are you telling them when they do that? And three, you need to do some research into what that means. So as I mentioned in my first job, what I was good about it was I realized what I wanted. And so my list read something like, I want to work downtown or south so I can have a better commute. I want to be making in this range of money. I want to work in a place that values diversity because I know I don't like working in a place that doesn't. And I want to work in a place that is supportive of my work with women who code because I think that that's important, right? Or at least that's like, cognizant that that's something that it's okay for me to do, right? Like maybe I take a call during work or something. So those are things that I prioritize. So I think you should prioritize what you want. You should do some research accordingly and start networking within those circles. I mean, there's a lot that you can do. Maybe you have a second connection to someone at a company that you're interested in. Ask your friend, hey, could you introduce me to this person? I want to ask them some questions about their company. Like that's totally reasonable to do. So you have to be, as my friend says, she uses this word all the time, intentional about what it is you want and then go and do it.
So you get your first job, you want to move on. You have your digital presence, your internet presence. Make sure that everybody who looks for you finds relevant things and not irrelevant things. Yeah. That's good. And then you have a good resume and you apply for jobs. How do you apply? Where do you go? Do you just go to LinkedIn or do you go to job sites or do you just talk to people and don't go to job sites? Do they work?
Sure. So yeah, so that's the thing. One thing that I think is really great about having a great LinkedIn profile, especially LinkedIn, is I found that recruiters who are more legitimate will find you on LinkedIn. If you have your LinkedIn cleanup, the non-sketchy recruiters will come on LinkedIn. Some sketchy ones too, but a little bit less sketchy than like just putting your resume on Dice and Indeed. My first position I found applying through Dice. So yes, the job sites do work. But my second position I found through a recruiter who works for a company that I had spoken with previously about other positions, and they were all really great. They kept up with me, I guess, because I also kept up with, you know, LinkedIn, right? So that's what I would say is the job sites do work. But I think most of the people I know who've gotten their second and their third jobs have done so through recruiters. I have a friend who started her kind of first PM / UX / developer position at this startup because I talked to a recruiter who I knew and then referred her. No, actually, my friend was recruited by this recruiter. Then I talked to them. Then I passed this on to her. So having that network through the LinkedIn, through the meetups is important because people might know, hey, you said you were looking for a job, right? Well, I talked to this lady, right? So that can happen. Obviously, I got a job off of Dice. So that also happens. And third, keeping up with LinkedIn, keeping up with these recruiters, the ones that treat you well, like treat them all back, you know, no, I don't know anybody, but thanks for sending this along, those kinds of things.
So that's good to know. You need to be everywhere. Essentially, if you were looking for your second job or even your first job or your third job, you don't know where is that job, right? You don't know which city. Maybe you want to stay within your current metro area, which is fine.
Sure.
But if you are very specific about the type of work you want to do, maybe you want to expand it a little bit. And the recruiters, generally, they are local. So if you live in Austin, Texas, for example, then there could be a set of really good Austin recruiters. But they may not really know about jobs in Tennessee, but maybe you don't care. Maybe you can live in Nashville and there is a fantastic job there. So putting it on Dice will allow you to reach more people.
Sure.
But also, you will get more spam.
But that
should be okay because you should be able to sift through it quickly and you'll get better at it over time. So then you apply for jobs and you need a good profile. So you need a good GitHub profile. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you need a good Stack Overflow profile. That can help.
Yeah.
Also, you need a very good, nice and organized LinkedIn profile, and you need to tie it all together. And I think what's important is that if people look at your resume, they should be able to find your GitHub and LinkedIn. If they go to LinkedIn, they should be able to find your GitHub, right? So make sure that the links are everywhere. And then, of course, you're doing open source. If you go to GitHub and you clone projects, and even if you just look at it, people will know that you cloned 10 things and they will know, okay, this is what this person is interested in.
Sure.
So it sets you apart from the vast majority of people just do what they're told at work. So it's luck of the draw. If you get to a great company with a bunch of great people, you will learn good things. Otherwise you won't, and you don't care beyond that. Well, you know, then you don't stand out. So, so all of that is good. Now we come to the point where you apply, you have a bunch of interviews lined up. Now, what are these interviews like? Are they one-on-one? Are they, you know, you just sitting in the middle and they're just surrounded by, you know, scary looking managers? How does that go?
Okay, so the second time around, what I would say, the second time around, I feel like it's like a double-edged sword because one, you have more knowledge, so you understand how much information is out there. So it's harder to study for interviews because you're like, okay, this is a front-end position. Like, what do I study? Like, where do I start? So, you know, ultimately what I would say is that, you know, it was a little bit easier because I did know more, but also more was expected of me. And so that's kind of where I struggled was I wasn't exactly sure what are, you know, the like 2.0 expectations for me and this interview round. Right. So, but yeah, so I mean, I think for me, what was easier too was the first time, obviously, I had an economic and a financial prerogative, like I need to find a job because I need money. But the second time around, it was very like, well, I don't really like this commute, so I'm not really gonna pursue this job, or I'm gonna go interview here just for the experience so that I can be practiced in interviewing, but I'm not really gonna follow through with this job. You can do things like that and it's not terrifying, and so the stakes aren't as high because you still have a paycheck. So that's what's really great the second time around. But I think, you know, what really kind of helped the second time around was, as I mentioned, I had been coding projects in my spare time. So I had a little bit more, I think it was an attitude. I had a bit more of authority because I could be like, well, you know, we tried it this way and it didn't work, so we had to try it this way. And even that way was limiting, but because like you can actually be an authority on something because you're working on stuff on your spare time. Whereas the first time around, you're basically just like, oh my God, give me a job. So, you know, that's what I would say would be the biggest difference is one, you do have a little bit more confidence. I probably should have studied maybe a little bit more for some of my interviews the second time around, but I wasn't super sure on what to study. But then I realized that, especially in front-end positions, and I'm sure the same thing is true for full stack, it's always the same questions. You know, tell me about a float. What is a float? Or what's display? Tell me about the display properties in CSS. It's usually going to be the same gotcha questions I ask at every single interview, right? Or like, what's the difference between an interface and what is it, an abstract object or whatever?
An abstract class.
Yeah, they always ask the same questions. So, you know, maybe they ask you to write a more complicated function, but it's always kind of the same kind of like fuzzy areas that you're going to be asked about. And then, but they're going to take your code more seriously, I think, the second time around because they assume you have more skill. So that's what I would say is the biggest difference.
So let me tell you a little secret.
Uh-huh.
When you are a new developer or a new professional in any field, you go for these interviews, you think, I don't know anything, and the person interviewing me knows so much and he's going to evaluate me. I'm insecure, he's secure. The reality is he's probably just as insecure as you are. And he's thinking, I'm not a good interviewer, I don't know what to ask, what if I'm found out, what if they realize I don't know Jack, I have all these deadlines, why am I doing this? All of these things are going through. That's why they're not prepared. That's why they end up asking you the same questions because probably they pulled it out of a website or something. And they don't take that much interest. That's a reality. That's sad because I take a lot of interest and I ask very pointed questions when I interview people.
I'm sure you do. Oh my gosh.
I have been told that I can be difficult, but I'm very good in evaluating. I want to put you through your paces, but I'm not going to evaluate you on your answers necessarily because that's not the point. Knowledge is easy to get, but the approach is hard. So there's that. So there's that part that people miss. And oftentimes when I go for interviews, so let me tell you a little bit of an inside thing. If I go for interviews, I have a swagger. I go in there. Yeah. I am confident about what I know. And I know that I know very little, but whatever I know it, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing is the person interviewing me perhaps is not sure what to ask me.
Yeah.
Because maybe he is insecure. Maybe he's not prepared. Maybe he's tired. Maybe, Notice I just said he and he and he because generally it's
almost always guys.
It's always men. But here's the thing. Throw them a bone. give them something to talk about. Give them a question to ask you. And the way you do that is to guide the questions through your answer. They're usually going to ask you, so tell me about yourself. Okay, this is your chance to shape this conversation. You can say, okay, so this is me. Don't go into your life detail. They don't care. But they want to know, okay, why they're asking you, make me care about you. And so you give them a thing, talk about a project, and this is what you did. You're excited about something. So naturally, they're going to ask you about that thing that you're excited about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. They do that.
And that's what happens all the time. So you can guide the interviewer and just hold their hands and walk them through a path. All they want to know is, are you competent? Are you good? Are you wasting my time? And if you are enthusiastic, you are convincing them, no, you're not wasting their time. You have knowledge and you have passion. And it may be completely different from what they had in mind, but it doesn't matter because most of the time they're just happy to see that. And so that's a little tip for everybody out there.
That's good to know. Yeah.
And it always works because they really appreciate somebody who takes interest in their craft, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And to your point real quick, usually it is mostly almost exclusively men that are going to be interviewing you, and almost always white men. I've did a lot of phone interviews the second time around, not so much whiteboarding, thankfully, but more kind of talking about code in a practical sense. So I wanted to throw that in there.
Excellent. So they might ask you to write, you know, go on a whiteboard and write a solution for a problem, just code something up. It happens. That's been pretty common. More recently, I've started seeing some pair programming sessions when they hook you up with a computer and you work with somebody else and watching your screen. And so you can ask questions. That's a completely different type of challenge. And sometimes they give you take home things. I mean, they want to evaluate if you can code, but let me tell you something else that, again, a lot of new developers might not know this. Not every type of programming job, not every type of company or the subsection of the industry that we're in, because they're different. There are different technologies and enterprises and startups and all different kinds of work that we can do. Not every one of them makes you go through a coding interview.
Yeah.
And that could be, I think that would come as a surprise to a lot of people, because most new developers or people who are starting out, they keep hearing about code this, code that, you know, Code Academy, just everything about coding. But there's more to software development than just programming and coding. There's other things and that are really valuable. And a lot of people, a lot of companies, they value that. And the coding is a small part of it, but that's the entire picture. And that's why I always like to bring people around to show them the full gamut of things that they can do. Not only that they can be, you know, kick-ass coders.
Yeah.
They could also be people who are coding, but that's not their main job. There are a lot of testers, automated testers that write code to test code. That's a completely different set of coding. And there's some people who do functional testing, load testing. There's some coding involved, but a lot of analysis. There could be business analysts. A lot of business analysts actually do write codes.
Yeah.
Excel macros and a little bitty codes, and coding really helps. So if you have some coding experience, but you feel like you're more interested in the analysis part, maybe you could be a business analyst. And there are lots of jobs for that. Not in startup companies. Generally, they're in big established industries like finance and so on, but they exist. And then obviously, not everybody is able to manage a project and so communicate to upper management.
Yeah.
And so make things happen. That's project management. All of these things are within the scope of software development.
Sure.
That's why I stay away from saying that we're programmers or we're coders, because we're more than that. And all of us are included in this. Basically, I want to include everybody. I don't want to miss UX. Very important. User experience designers and web designers. They're all part of this large umbrella called software development. So I just want to point it out. If you think you suck as a programmer, It may be true. It's possible. Not everybody is cut out to be a programmer. You can still be in technology. You can still be in a software company and do something that requires some programming knowledge, but that's not your core task.
Mm-hmm. So, and you might even like it better. I mean,
yeah, some people are suitable for that. I know so many developers who are really good coders, right? They can code up things very quickly, but they are terrible project managers. Or they will make the worst testers. Because in order for you to test, you need to think analytically. You need to think in segments. You sort of need to segment things out and be very thorough. And I have not seen a lot of developers. Unfortunately, the testing that we do is not very adequate. There's a manual testing part. There's functional. There's load testing and all the other kinds of testing. But there's also automated testing. And in some companies, you will be surprised to know that there are dedicated automated testers. So developers don't do their own testing, or they don't write unit tests or integration tests. And they're just other people whose job is to just write end-to-end tests. And so in a programming language, but it's a much simpler paradigm. They don't have to know so much. And a lot of people like that idea of, you know, running through their paces.
Sure.
So you can still make it in this field if you think you suck as a programmer. And by the way, I've thought that I suck. In fact, I think I do suck as a programmer, but I'm sticking around. I'm not giving up.
That's awesome.
It was a pleasure talking to you, because I really want people to know that it's important to get your first job, but that's not the end of the world. Most of the time, your first job is not going to be a great job for you. It may be a great job for somebody else, but not for you, because you were kind of desperate at that time. You didn't know what's good. You didn't know yourself. You didn't know what's your strength, what's your weakness. You just get a job. And you don't negotiate terms. And then you find, okay, you're in a place where it's hard to work with people. You're not respected. Perhaps you're not making enough money. Now I feel like you can make, you know, $10,000, $20,000 more. But you won't be able to do it in the current position, because the way the companies work, a lot of times you don't get large raises like that.
So yeah,
The best way to make more money is to go to another job. And so the way to do that is to present yourself in a way that is appealing to that next company, right? And so the first thing you do is make sure the work that you're doing, you document that and make sure you do a really good job, so get good references, but also let people know. You have to let people know this is what you have done. And because, you know, you got to market yourself. You got to promote yourself, because if you don't do it, then nobody else will do it, because nobody cares about you other than you.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you have to, in a certain sense, if you're working in technology and or transitioning to technology, you have to be very purposeful about, like, you know, at some point, obviously it might take you some time to figure it out, but you have to be like, what do I want out of this? Where do I want to be? How much money do I want to make? Do I want to be working 40 hours a week? Do I want to work? I mean, you have to kind of do that, because you can just very easily get into it and just float there and never know that you can have more. And I know people like that. They're talented. They have, you know, the skill, they have the acumen to make that leap, but they're comfortable, or they're scared, or whatever. So, you know, if you want something, you can get it, but you have to plan for it and take the steps.
Yeah, that's great advice. But I remember we were having this conversation earlier. You give a talk at South by Southwest on a very similar topic, and there was a question, and that question is relevant. And I think a lot of people that are listening right now, they might be thinking, oh, I don't want to create this impression that this is a job hopper. This person is not dedicated, right? That's a thought that a lot of people have. Okay, I've just been here for a year or 6 months, and I know that I'm miserable, but I don't want people to think that I'm not dedicated and I'm job hopper. So what do you say to that?
What I say to that is that two things. One, I think especially in our current economic climate, people don't get to stay at jobs for 10, 20 years. Like even the big tech companies like Dell and Intel and whatever, IBM, they have mass layoffs. So even if you wanted to stay 10 years at one company, good luck with that. You know, like, it's just not as common as it once was. Secondly, I've never seen anyone penalized for job hopping. I mean, people ask me about it. Well, you've only been here for so long. Why do you want to leave? And you come up with a tactful answer for that, but doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to get the job or you're not going to get the interview. You know, I think you're the one, I think I really liked what you said, which was that the only person who, the only people who think that it's bad are the people who you're leaving. And I think the another thing to take into account is in technology, from what I've been able to tell, people expect high turnover. That's why you have all these recruiters. If everyone was staying at their companies all the time, you wouldn't need all these recruiters because you wouldn't have so many openings. But people job hop all the time. It's not something people don't expect.
That's certainly true. And also because technology, especially in the web arena and also in other parts of software development, but at a lower pace, but a lot of people are working in web development and web development technologies change. So
yeah,
if you don't change with them, then you stagnate sort of. So people understand that's why there's a lot of hiring, because maybe 2 years later, they're using different technology stacks and you no longer have the right skill set. So they may want to, you know, either have you learn something new or get something else, somebody else who can fill the needs. So you got to keep moving. Either way, either, yeah, if you want to stay in the same company, that's fantastic. Because I know some people who have been in the same company for decades and they're fantastic people. But that's because they had the right fit. They gelled together. They worked together. They trusted each other and they were able to grow. So if you want to become a world-class web developer and you start now in your first year, you're not world-class, but you say, okay, in 5 years, 10 years, I want to be one of the best. Okay, well, then you need to have a progression there. And if your company's not letting you do that...
Hello?
Yes. Did you lose me?
I lost you. Okay, so you said if you're not going to be a world-class developer, but if you're confident, I think is what you were saying.
I was going to say that if your company is not letting you achieve your goals, if it's in your way, right? Because the goals don't align. But maybe that's not a good fit. And we understand that. As technologists, as people who have gone through this process before, we understand that a lot of times the fit is not good. And they have no qualms. Employers have no issues letting you go.
Yeah.
They won't hesitate at all. So you shouldn't hesitate either. But at the same time, don't leave for the sake of leaving. We understand that. You might find a group of people who are supportive, who are growing together with you, then great. And especially it can work if you work on a project-based type of setting where maybe it's a consulting organization where you work on a project and then another project. And maybe as your worth grows, then you make more money because you bring in more money. There's a lot of arrangements that you can encounter. So it is a legitimate thing to stay where you are for 10 years, but it's perfectly fine to leave, especially if this is in alignment with your overall goals. Because as I said before, you are the only person in charge of your career, and don't leave it to your boss. They really don't care.
They don't care. And to your point, I forgot what I was going to say.
To all of my points, let's end it there, because I know that we have to go. This has been a fantastic interview, and I love talking to you. We've become friends since our first interview, and I'm just having a blast talking to you. And everybody who's listening to us, if you want to get ahead, if you want to get your first job, your second job, your third job, you can do it. And
yeah, absolutely can.
And Sara, you have written about some of your struggles in learning programming, and you have blogs, and you're you know, pretty active socially. So how can people get in touch with you if they have a question for you?
Sure. So Twitter's probably the best thing. And you can just Google me, because you'll find all the same branding everywhere. But it's just Sara Chica D, Saracica, D like dog. So Sara Chica D on Twitter, Sara Chica D on Medium. But Twitter is a really good way. That's how I met you, Arslan. It's been really great medium for me to meet and connect with tech people. So if you're not on Twitter and you're thinking about, like, you know, switching jobs or getting involved, you need to be on Twitter. And yeah, feel free to reach out to me there.
Great. And you can tweet at us at mentoringdevs, MENTORINGDEVS. And I'd love to get some emails. I've been getting some emails from people who are interested in being part of the show. Send me your questions, send me your comments, complaints, you know, tell me you hate me or you love me. Either way, we just want to know if this is connecting with this, if you are affected by this podcast. So the email address is us@mentoringdevelopers.com. The website is mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and whatever the episode number. So if you want to listen to Sara's first interview, you go to mentoringdevelopers.com/episode18. And yeah, you can go from there. If you want to be part of this show, I'd love for you to be a guest. If you have something to say, if you have an opinion, whether you agree or disagree, especially if you are a new developer or an aspiring developer, you want to be a developer, you're not sure, or you're just starting out and you have a lot of questions, come on the show and we can talk about it and everybody can benefit from it. Or maybe you're somebody who hires developers, who mentors them, and you can give us some tips on what works and what doesn't work. So all that is really good. Be a guest or participate in a discussion panel. Either way, the way to do that is go to mentoringdevelopers.com/join. That's it. Awesome. All right, Sara.
Thank you so much for having me. Good luck, everyone. Find me on Twitter if you have any questions.
Yeah, find Sara and say hi. Okay, see ya.
Ciao. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can read the highlights and show notes with links on mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. For example, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode 10 or /episode 25 and so on. Let me know what you think about this episode. If you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment, you can email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. Oh, and one more thing. I really want you to be part of the show, even if you are a little shy. So go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.